we found no basis to conclude that potential impacts from climate change contribute significantly to the extinction risk.
Some populations of humpback whales come off the endangered species list. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, cleanup continues on a fuel spill along the Richardson Highway.
None of it is in the lake. There was some standing water in the ditch that had fuel on it, and they were recovering that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
There was a shakeup this afternoon in Alaska's U.S. Senate race. Fairbanks attorney Joe Miller announced today that he will challenge Senator Lisa Murkowski after all. Miller says Libertarian nominee C.N. Stevens has withdrawn from the race and her party's leadership has agreed to let Miller appear on the general election ballot in her place. 6 years ago, Miller ran as a Tea Party-style Republican and beat Murkowski in the primary. Murkowski retained her seat, though, by mounting a write-in campaign for the general. By then, Miller's campaign was sinking under a pile of revelations about his past and the handcuffing of a news reporter at one of Miller's campaign events by men acting as Miller's security guards. In his emailed announcement of his candidacy, Miller accuses Murkowski of being too liberal and says he's running to offer voters a real choice. Other candidates in the race include independent Margaret Stock and Democratic nominee Ray Metcalf. The Democratic primary results, state primary results for District 40 House seat grew closer today. Dean Westlake remains ahead of incumbent State Representative Benjamin Nagiak, but Westlake's lead was cut to 4 votes. The State Election Review Board certified the results in Juneau, adding absentee ballots and adjusting other returns. Nagiak picked up 17 votes, while Westlake's total didn't change. Westlake leads 819 votes to 815. Nagiak, or 10 qualified voters, have 5 days to ask for a recount. The state pays for any recounts in elections where the margin is 20 or fewer votes. Nagiak has caucused with House Republicans. Alaska Republican Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock criticized the Division of Elections for certifying the results. He cited irregularities in how the election was conducted in some precincts.
It's an absurdity that the review board or the Division of Elections director can claim that they can certify who actually won that election.
But Division of Elections Director Josie Banky says she wanted to certify District 40 first to resolve a potential recount sooner. Nagiak has hired Seattle-based lawyer Timothy McKeever to advise him. McKeever says a recount request is likely. Much of the concern has focused on the results in Shungnak, where voters were allowed to vote in both the Republican primary and in the primary for all other parties. Westlake received 47 votes in Shungnak, compared with 3 for Nagiak. Westlake lost 1 vote, while Nagiak gained 1 in Shungnak as a result of the election review. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced today that most humpback whales will come off the endangered species list. And that means some whales that spend time in Alaska. But some subgroups of humpbacks around the world will remain on the list. 3 different humpback populations visit Alaska, and now they all fall into different categories. The Hawaii population is delisted. The Mexico population is still labeled as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The Western North Pacific humpback, which feeds in the Bering Sea and Aleutian Chain, is still listed as endangered. Marta Namick, a NOAA Endangered Species Act coordinator, says with the different types of humpbacks,
and our Alaska region is going to have to use a proportional approach to decide what population is being affected by different things that may happen, like vessel strikes or fishing gear entanglements.
NAMIC says fishing gear entanglement is a serious threat to the western North Pacific humpback, and that's expected to increase. The Mexico population of humpbacks labeled as threatened feed in southeast Alaska waters. NOAA said there isn't enough data to indicate a population increase. Angela Soma, chief of NOAA's Endangered Species Division, says the agency looked at the impact of climate change on humpbacks and whether that could affect the overall population down the line.
There certainly are issues to be concerned about, but we found no basis to conclude that potential impacts from climate change contribute significantly to the extinction risk for these populations now or even in the foreseeable future.
Commercial whaling in the 1800s and early 1900s significantly reduced the humpback population. It was listed under the Endangered Species Conservation Act in 1970 and later the Endangered Species Act in 1973. A cleanup operation continues along the Richardson Highway south of Fairbanks, where a tanker trailer went off the road and leaked fuel. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation on-scene coordinator Tom DeRider says the Monday afternoon accident occurred near mile 306 at Birch Lake, where a truck operated by Big State Logistics lost one of two fuel tankers it was pulling.
The trailer became disconnected, and right now we don't know why that happened. That's a fairly unusual event.
DeRider says the trailer did not cross traffic, and no one was hurt in the accident. The overturned tanker was carrying 5,000 gallons of fuel, and DeRider says a significant amount of it spilled into the ditch on the opposite side of the highway from the lake.
None of it is in the lake. There was some standing water in the ditch that had fuel on it, and they were recovering that.
DeRider says he expects the spill response to continue for at least a few more days as fuel and contaminated soil are removed from the site. The DEC and Alaska State Troopers are investigating the incident. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a popular fashion magazine depicts the Mendenhall Glacier as completely melted.
They did a really good job of fact-checking. I got follow-ups from them about this fact and that fact, and they just missed this one.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The number of minors detained by the state's Division of Juvenile Justice has dropped by almost 50% over the past decade. The reason behind the decrease isn't completely clear, but it's a nationwide trend. KTOO's Quinton Chandler reports.
When a minor is arrested or charged with a crime, they are generally referred to the Division of Juvenile Justice for punishment or treatment or both. Juvenile Justice says the number of kids being sent their way was almost cut in half over the last 10 years.
Most of the kids never see the inside of one of our buildings.
That's Rob Wood, Juvenile Justice Director.
We deal with them informally or with parental supervision rather than put them in one of our programs.
Wood has seen the decrease firsthand. He started with Juvenile Justice in 1990.
We've seen a fairly steady decrease for about the last 15 years. When I started with the division as a probation officer, my office in Anchorage got more cases referred to it than the entire state does now.
Wood doesn't know for certain why the number of referrals fell off so dramatically, but he has some ideas.
We have better services in the communities. We have better mental health services. We have better responses. Kind of up and down the continuum, and perhaps that is leading to less kids being arrested.
Melissa Sickmond is the director of the National Center for Juvenile Justice. She agrees with Wood, but wants to approach the question from a different direction.
You're asking the question about why did things come down. I think we need to step back and first ask why had they gone up.
To help make her point, Sickmond led me to a graph.
The easiest way to do it is to Google the words statistical briefing book, and that takes you to a link that is on...
The graph gives us a picture of how violent juvenile crime arrests changed over more than 30 years. It begins in 1980, starts climbing in the late 80s, and jumps really high in the mid-90s.
For people who are old like me, you can remember that time. People were very fearful of kids. There was actually a lot of kind of blaming kids for all the violence in the country, which was not accurate. But, you know, it got everybody's attention.
The line starts falling hard after a peak in 1994. Sickman says each year she waited in suspense to see if the crime numbers had fallen again.
Oh, yeah, it did.
They kept going down. There were years when they rose again, but not by much, and then they fell even more. Sickman emphasizes this is national data, and every community is different, but numbers from Alaska show a similar trend. So why did it happen? Sickman points to one specific drug.
People have hypothesized about crack hitting the streets and the violence associated with the crack market and all that. I don't know if that's an issue in Alaska. You know, did you have a lot of gangs on the streets selling crack?
Wood says yes. Yes, we did.
Maybe that was in part because of the transiency of population. There's a lot of money to be made in drugs, and crack was an easy drug to manufacture, and some of the gangs out of California moved into Alaska, not necessarily to be gangs, but to be businessmen.
Wood and Sickman both say the crack industry was extremely violent, and Sickman says kids played a big role in it. Now she's ready to talk about why juvenile crime stopped getting worse.
Everybody responded to it.
Parents, schools, law enforcement, legislatures.
There was a lot of money put into the system. There was also a lot of money spent on research to try to understand what was going on, what happens with kids, what works with kids, and with adults too. Everybody did what they thought, you know, they could do to reduce the violence, and then eventually it turned around.
The result in Alaska is 8 youth detention facilities housing fewer juveniles than they could hold. And partly because of lower utilization, the Ketchikan facility is scheduled to close later this month. Wood says back in the 90s, the Anchorage Youth Center was supposed to hold 30 kids, but it averaged about 70. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Licensed childcare availability is up more than 20% in Juneau compared to last year, according to a local organization. Childcare providers and its supporters say that's good news for a market that's historically struggled to meet demand. KTOO's Lakeed Rashavis has the story.
The Association for the Education of Young Children is a Juneau-based organization that researches and provides services for childcare in Southeast Alaska. Joy Lyon is the executive director.
We're really excited that now we have 21% more childcare spaces than we did that last year this time. So there's an increase of 80-some spaces that is a result of three different initiatives.
One of the big initiatives relaxed city zoning rules that apply to childcare centers, which the Juneau Assembly passed late last year. One change lets at-home childcare providers have up to 12 kids instead of 8 without needing a permit from the city.
The zoning laws have led to 4 new group homes, so they're able to provide support for more children. And that's a model we hope to encourage for the other 30 family childcare providers. And then 2 new centers have started since last year, which has led to the increase. And one of the centers would not have been able to start without that change in the zoning laws.
That center is the Gearing Nursery School. And on a recent morning there, about a dozen babies and children are running around, eating snacks and preparing to paint. Some are even crowding in a circle to listen to an impromptu story time. The 5 women that work at the daycare also have their own children here. One teacher says watching her children grow up while working is a bonus. Amy Myers is an administrator at the daycare. She says when she got pregnant 2 years ago, one of her first thoughts was, what about childcare?
Oh my gosh, what I do. I knew that daycare was the biggest challenge facing new parents here in town. At the time, I had a really good job with really good pay. But I heard that there were wait lists for pretty much every daycare And then not only were there wait lists for childcare here in town, there was also very limited infant spots.
She says if you're lucky, the search starts early.
So really it's that moment that you find out you're pregnant, you have to get on a wait list for somewhere, and then things change.
Myers decided to be a stay-at-home mom and eventually started working at the daycare center. Izzy Keiko Gehring runs the center and says just 2 years ago, it couldn't have existed under the city's zoning rules for child care providers.
I went to whoever was available first, and Kathy Munoz and Jesse Keel were available for half an hour meeting with me, and that's exactly where it started.
That was in 2014. Then, like now, Munoz was a state representative from Juneau, and Keel was a member of the Juneau Assembly. Those meetings eventually led to the zoning changes. Joy Lyon with the AUIC says two other initiatives have also contributed to additional childcare availability.
And then we have the Hearts Initiative that's sponsored by the city, and that provides an education award and a retention award for early childhood teachers.
The third initiative is a $1,000 grant that Lyon's organization offers to new childcare startups. Keiko Gehring says turnover is another factor.
Part of that reason, I think a lot of younger families are moving. We've had at least 10 families in the last year to move out of state, young families.
She says that Juneau has an aging community, and the cost of childcare here forces families to make important decisions. For mothers, she says, do you work and pay $1,000 a month for your child to be in daycare, or do you stay home and watch them grow up?
There's a lot that is involved in this 21% increase, and it has to be looked at like from every angle. The 21% increase could also mean that less women are in the workforce right now.
Keiko Gehring says her center isn't at capacity. She says that's a good thing. Her workers aren't overwhelmed. But when they do open a spot, it's filled almost immediately. When I called around to a few other daycare centers in Juneau, all of them had long wait lists, especially for infants. But for the first time in 5 years, the downward trend for licensed childcare spots is slowly moving up. In Juneau, I'm Lakedra Chavis.
The magazine Marie Claire sent a team of journalists and fashionistas to the Mendenhall Glacier this summer. The story that appeared in its September issue is called On Thin Ice. Can the fashion industry help save the planet? But as first reported in the Juneau Empire, the magazine got a couple of key things wrong. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins explains.
It felt like I was in Frozen. That's the only way to describe it. I was in Frozen.
That's Nina Garcia, the creative director of Marie Claire, describing what it's like to enter the ice caves at the Mendenhall Glacier. You've probably spotted the magazine when you wait in line at the supermarket. This month's cover featured Sarah Jessica Parker. And inside, there was an article about the effects of climate change on glacier ice and how the fashion industry can help by reducing wasteful packaging. But some of the photo captions are pretty off. Or as Nina Garcia would say, as a judge on Project Runway,
I think you made a real big effort, however.
However, one of the pictures looked like it had been put through an Instagram filter. It was supposed to depict the Mendenhall Glacier in 1970.
And we know that at that time, Nugget Falls was falling. Well, in the 70s, you know, it was falling onto the glacier.
John Neary, the director at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, says he thinks the photo was actually taken sometime in the 1990s. Then there was another photograph in the magazine spread, captioned "The Mendenhall Glacier Today."
The other photo was more strange. It was, from what I can tell, a picture from the top of Thunder Mountain, looking at that Thunder Mountain basin with the airport behind it and then North Douglas.
You can see a rolling mountain with grass and only a little bit of snow. No glacier anywhere in sight. When the article came out, Neary says he was in Denali National Park on a vacation. And initially, he was disappointed. But he recognizes everyone makes mistakes.
And I don't fault them for it because it's a long, long ways away from where they are. And they did a really good job of fact-checking. I got follow-ups from them about this fact and that fact, and they just missed this one.
No doubt, the Mendenhall Glacier is shrinking. In the past 30 years, Neary's noticed an extreme change, and scientists say the glacier won't be visible from the visitor center by the end of this century. Neary says even though Marie Claire got the photos very wrong, he found the overall message of the story interesting.
It's from a different take than I would write an article on, but at the same time, people are coming from really different places than I am, too. And if they're coming from the New York fashion scene, then maybe that article really appeals to their sensibilities.
As the Marie Claire article concluded, you shouldn't have to choose between fashion and the glacier. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum. The 2016 Alaska State Fair will be completely smoke-free, protecting all fairgoers from exposure to tobacco smoke and the aerosol from electronic smoking devices. If you use tobacco or e-cigarettes, now is a great time to connect with Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line for free support, to set a quit date, and then breathe easy at the Alaska State Fair. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
For the third year in a row, a record high number of coho salmon have been caught in the Lower Yukon commercial fishery. As of September 1st, 141,000 coho were caught and sold in Yukon River Districts 1 and 2. That tops the previous record of about 130,000 set last year. All of those coho were essentially bycatch in the fall chum commercial fishery, which sent more than 415,000 fish to market this year. Fish and Game's preseason forecast for coho called for an average to below average run in 2016. But as Fish and Game's Yukon fall season manager Jeff Estensen explains, the coho run appears to be coming back stronger than that.
We really don't have an idea of what the run size is right now, but the passage we have past pilot station sonar through the 31st, which is one pilot station sonar stops operating for the fall season, is sitting at 167,000 fish, which is certainly above the median passage for coho.
Based on indications of a stronger-than-expected run, Fish and Game is giving the green light to directed commercial openings for coho on the Lower Yukon. But the general manager of Quipuc Fisheries, Jack Schulteis, does not anticipate that the September coho openings will add very much to the already record-breaking harvest totals.
I don't expect a lot of fish, 5,000-6,000 fish, maybe tops. And we don't have the effort that, we would have during August or even a couple weeks ago. A lot of people are getting ready for winter and, they're hunting and gathering wood.
With more pressure on coho, Estensen with Fish and Game says it would be helpful to get more information about the Yukon coho stock, which he calls the least understood of all the major salmon species that return to the Yukon.
We're trying to do a telemetry study or trying to get funding to do studies like that because that could provide us a lot of information, give us more handle on the timing coming back, but more also importantly is getting distribution within the drainage. And then we'd be able to take that information and certainly improve our monitoring of coho to try to get a better handle on things.
There is only one escapement goal for coho salmon in the Yukon drainage compared to six for king salmon. Last week in Togiak, two couples moved into their new HUD houses. They were the first in the state to take advantage of a down payment assistance program from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. With that, the Martins and the Nicks will have roughly half the mortgage payment to make and took deed to their homes on day one. KDLG's Dave Benninger was there as they moved in.
It was a moment for some celebration in the village.
Hallelujah!
Laura and Nels Martin paused at their front door Wednesday for pictures as a set of keys were handed over. A dozen or more people helped cheer them on as they took ownership of their new home.
I want to cry, but I was there.
All on hand toured the new four-bedroom house, unfurnished but complete with new appliances and a spectacular view across a meadow to the hills. It was built to six-star energy efficiency, meaning it's tight, warm, and has LED lighting throughout. As her first guests filed out, Laura Nels was so excited her words were getting away from her a bit.
Today is the happiest days of my moment to get a brand new house, and I feel like I'm very blessed. And thank you for BBHA and BIA for helping me out.
Brenda Acklecock is the executive director of the Bristol Bay Housing Authority and was admittedly a little emotional as the Martins and Nicks stepped into their new homes.
Well, it's the first time in the state of Alaska that the BIA Housing Improvement Program, Down Payment Assistance Program, has ever been used by a family.
She says regulations were just passed in Congress last December, allowing the Bureau of Indian Affairs to work closer with tribes and with the Housing Authority for what Acklecock calls a wonderful new program.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs provided $75,000 as a down payment for each family. Because of that, they were able to qualify for a mortgage through Bristol Bay Housing Authority. They get the deed to their home right up front instead of waiting 15 years of making payments in the old lease-to-own program. So we're very proud of Togiak and these two families.
And with that down payment, the 15-year mortgage price was dropped from $300 a month to just $172. Of course, working through two programs meant a mountain of paperwork, and Acklecock commended the two families for sticking through the process. In her house, just next door, Sophie Nick checked the space and the amenities. There's a gun safe provided, propane stove, cold well water, and two sources of heat, including an oil drip stove in the living room that'll add some ambiance. These homes cost roughly $400,000 to build in Bristol Bay, but the Housing Authority says they are built to last and easy to maintain. Nick says she and her husband John had waited in line for a HUD home for years, but on Wednesday, they had the deed to their new home in hand, a manageable mortgage, and an excited outlook for the years ahead.
I'm happy about it because I've been praying about it, that I applied for the housing for how many years? Finally approved.
She says all that was left to do on Wednesday was start moving in the furniture. Reporting from Togiak, I'm Dave Benninger.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Andrew Kitchenman, Quentin Chandler, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Lakeed Rashavis in Juneau, Tim Bedoni in Galena, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message brought to you by Alaska PTAC.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.